Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Mass Office Hours. I am Eric Trexler. I'm joined by Dr. Mike Zordos tonight. We are both here on behalf of the Mass Research Review. Thanks so much for joining us, as you likely do every Wednesday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. We have a lot to cover in today's episode. And to start things off, Mike, we are going to be talking a little bit about rest intervals. And I understand that you've got a little bit of a presentation, so to speak, about rest intervals. So why don't you go ahead and get us started tonight?
Yeah, people are calling in a presentation. You know, I've done a few of these before in office hours. I'm not saying this is the best one, but, you know, some people haven't heard it yet. Nobody's heard it yet, but people are already talking about it out there as the top one. So wouldn't be surprised. I think you previously said there were somewhere between 100 and 100,000 people joining an episode. Wouldn't be surprised if we start getting closer to that 100,000 mark tonight.
Yep.
Yeah, most likely. So,
well, actually, wait, before you get into that, I must do the obligatory, hey, everyone, if you like the show, there's ways to support it. A lot of ways to do that. The first thing is, if you're in the live chat right now, go ahead and hit the like button before you forget. That's always really important and very helpful. Like, rate, subscribe, review, wherever you access Mass Office Hours. Share it with a friend. Send them a link. If you really love what we're doing, you could also check out massresearchreview.com and think about subscribing to the Mass Research Review, which goes out every single month, the first of the month. We got a new issue coming out in less than a week, so now would be a great time to subscribe and get that new issue in a few days here. And then if you want to be part of the show, we answer real questions from people like you. You can submit questions through our portal, which is always open. That link is at massresearchreview.com/officehours. It's in the description of today's episode. But the best way to ask us a question is to join us live and be part of the show every Wednesday night. Okay, Mike, here you go.
All right. So, you know, over the years, there's been some kind of quintessential topics in the research related to strength and hypertrophy that have kind of shifted over time, right? You know, Trex, going into your world of nutrition a bit. By the way, the Mass team still has not accepted me into the nutrition department, despite a couple really, really good articles. It's a shame. People are saying that this has kind of been an unfair process. But, you know, the message on protein timing has shifted over the years, if I may venture into that world a little bit. And something else that's shifted over the years has been the messaging on rest intervals or interset rest times. And so this is something that I covered in Mass for the issue that's coming out on April 1st and is actually going to be part of our email newsletter that comes out on April 1st. So if you don't get that newsletter, you can go to massresearchreview.com and sign up for it. But these guidelines have kind of shifted over the years. And so textbooks years ago had these recommendations for rest intervals. But since they've changed, you know, I've started to wonder if it's actually a bit more nuanced than what we're seeing, because we see paradigm shifts, right? And so the old school recommendations for rest intervals for hypertrophy, 30, 60, 90 seconds. And then we see these paradigm shifts, you should rest really long for hypertrophy. Well, maybe there's a bit more nuance to it than that. So I want to kind of give a comprehensive overview here of interset rest. And so how long should rest intervals be? What do the data say for both strength and hypertrophy? So thanks, Trex, for bringing up the guide. And as always, when you bring it up, you cover up your face and leave just me. And that's really where the viewers come in. So as everybody can see on our screen here, we have this guide. And on the top here, we have the questions. So these are all of the questions I want to answer as we kind of take our venture through this guide. So these four big questions around this that we'll get through are, what is better for acute performance, short or long rest intervals? So essentially, from set to set, you do four or five sets of an exercise. If you do short or long rest intervals, what's going to maintain performance better? Now, that's pretty self-explanatory. I can spoil the story right here and say longer rest intervals. But what's important is maybe the degree to which the performance will decrease from set to set. What's better for long-term outcomes, short or long rest intervals? Does this differ for strength or for hypertrophy? Again, this is the main question here, and this, I think, has had a paradigm shift that's possibly gone too far. It used to say for hypertrophy, short rest intervals. Now people are saying long rest intervals. I think we can add some nuance to that discussion. Our third big question, What are the other factors that affect rest interval length, meaning exercise selection and proximity to failure? The article that I reviewed in the April 1st issue of Mass talks about the effect of proximity to failure on rest interval length and how it affects fatigue. And then how long should you rest exactly, right? So we're going to have all of these things, and it's great to talk about the research. We're the Mass Research Review. That's what we do. But ultimately, whenever we have a topic like this, I do believe in distilling it down the best we can to give some sort of recommendation and not just saying, hey, it depends. Because yes, it does depend and everything depends. But can we get a bit more specific for how long we should rest? What are our generable, actionable guidelines for that? Some additional notes at the end I won't spend much time on now, but what should you do between sets? If you're resting for a couple minutes, is there anything you can do with that time to make it more useful? And then do you actually need to time your rest intervals? Do you need to sit there and look at the clock, look at a stopwatch, and so forth? So a few housekeeping before we get into these four items. So these four questions here and these bullet points at the top, we're going to have a page on each of them. So what is long and short rest? How do we define that? Well, these are relative terms. So I always find it a bit funny when we compare different studies, and one study may have compared 2-minute rest intervals to 1-minute rest intervals and may have concluded that the longer rests were better. Another study may have done 5 minutes versus 3 minutes and may have concluded that the longer rest was better. So now we have 2 minutes winning in one study and 5 minutes winning in another. The fireworks, I am crushing it. If you were watching live, this is the second time I've done that. It seems to be this gesture right here.
You know, Mike, so, I got to be honest, man. We have never had any of these things happen with any other person on office hours. And you are always getting like fireworks and thumbs up things exploding out from behind you. I don't know what it is.
This is why I'm clearly the preferred guest. I think it's unfortunate you haven't had this when other people have been on. And I'm going to do my best to see if I can make it 2 fireworks in one episode. To Becky's question, there is probably a thing as too much rest, and I will get to that. And so those are relative terms when we think of short or long rest. Now, what's the main narrative? Before we dive into our first question, why are we here? Well, for years, you've read textbooks, and if you studied exercise science in school, you've heard that the acute anabolic hormone release was essential for maximizing muscle hypertrophy. And this seems to occur best with short rest intervals. Thus, for hypertrophy, we heard that moderate repetitions and higher volumes, which to this day are probably true, at least practically, the moderate repetitions are going to be preferable for hypertrophy. With shorter rest intervals, 30 to 90 seconds are going to be superior for hypertrophy. Now, the reason that this happened is there was a lot of correlational data to show that, hey, when folks are doing more volume and they're resting shorter, we're seeing these increases in these anabolic hormones, and then that's correlated with muscle growth. Well, a lot of these early studies, there aren't necessarily comparisons to longer rests. And if they are, the shorter rests, they packed in a lot more volume. And so they said, all right, instead of concluding that volume was responsible for the growth, they concluded that the acute anabolic hormone release. And so one of the factors to point out here is if we take growth hormone, for example, under acidic conditions, growth hormone releasing hormone binds better to the anterior pituitary, which stimulates the release of growth hormone. Now, when we say acidic conditions, this means a decrease in pH. When you're taking shorter rest intervals, there's less time for lactate to clear. So muscle pH, blood pH goes down, we have these acidic conditions, and we have these increases in acute anabolic hormones. This was called the, quote, hormone hypothesis. So that's why we're here, and that's why the controversy, if you will, over rest intervals, that's why all this discussion. So we've kind of gone the other way now and recommended longer rest intervals. So with that background out of the way, let's get to these four questions, and we will get back in our second question to these long-term outcomes and if that hormone hypothesis does hold up. So thinking of our four bullet points, the first one was the simple one. And we scroll down here to the next page here, Trex. And number one, what is better for acute performance, meaning short or long rest intervals? So the bottom line here we have at the top, really short rest intervals won't allow for sufficient inter-set recovery. decreasing performance from set to set at a greater rate than longer rest intervals. While this is pretty intuitive, I think we all know if we rest for 30 seconds as opposed to 3 minutes, we're not going to recover as well. But how does this look in actuality in practice? So I made a table here from a study from Radimus in 2012. And we can see in the left-hand column, they compared 1 minute rest intervals versus 2 minute versus 3 minute. So these more short, moderate, and longer rest intervals, both women and men in this study. Now looking at a 10 RM on the first set, we can see about 10 reps were performed. And then with the 1 minute rest, we can see the decrease in performance. The 2 minute rest, the decrease in performance is less, and the 3 minute rest, not so much. So if we just take men here, for example, because they seem to have a bit more of a fatigue rate from set to set, so it's accentuated a bit more. So for 1 minute rest, men had a 29% decrease in performance from set one to set two, which was about three reps with 1 minute rest. After that, they lost about another three reps. When they went to 2 minutes, they had a little less than two reps lost, or 17%. And then they had about a 40% loss total, which was less than the 60% loss total in the 1 minute condition. And then the 3 minute condition, by the third set, they had only lost 22%, or about two reps of their rep performance, and as opposed to 40% and 60%. So pretty straightforward, but it does give you a gauge of the magnitude of difference between rest intervals, meaning that the short rest seems to really impair performance from set to set. Now, other factors that we're going to talk about later, like proximity to failure, also seems to really impair performance from set to set if you're taking short rest. So it's really important to note that, yes, longer rest intervals are going to allow for better recovery, but the really short rest, the 30 seconds, the 1 minute, are really impairing performance from set to set. So what we want to do is take a look at how that really affects long-term outcomes. So our take-homes here are just what we just said, right? The shorter rest are really going to impair performance acutely. Now, number two is really, as we scroll to the next page, the most important question that we have here is the one that we're probably going to spend a bit more time on. And so what is better for long-term outcomes? This is that hormone hypothesis. This is what I've been said for years. We have these short rest intervals, and that's going to stimulate these acute anabolic hormones. And all right, so we need to do that to maximize muscle growth. Well, the bottom line here is that when compared directly in the literature, you can see underlined, longer rest intervals generally lead to better strength and hypertrophy. That was what was in textbooks for years for strength. Longer rest intervals make sense. You can maintain lifting a heavier load, but longer rest intervals seem to win out overall for hypertrophy. Now, there are a lot of caveats here. Before we get to those caveats, if we kind of take a look at this table, right? This table is most of the research that has compared short and long rest. And so if Trex can scroll with me here as we look at the right-hand column, and then we're going to go back up. So when we look at each of these studies, longer rest better for strength or hypertrophy with a question mark. And we can see yes in this one study, no in another study, but there was no difference. Yes in another study. Yes in the quintessential Schoenfeld study that I'm sure we're all familiar with. No in a couple more, right? But there's no time where shorter rest really seemed to outperform longer rest. So Trucks, we can go back up to the top now. And so we're either seeing neutral findings or we're seeing findings in favor of taking longer rest. But I said there's some caveats associated with this, because remember, I said that I thought the paradigm shifted too much. Based upon this, you would say, yeah, I should probably rest longer. But these findings are when sets or total volume are equated. So if we just think of volume in terms of sets, because that's how we tend to talk about it these days, and that is kind of the simplest way to describe it in this fashion. Yes, longer rest intervals do tend to be better for muscle growth, but the big caveat is when sets are equated. And if you think about this logically, if you're doing four sets on an exercise and you're going to do four sets on squat at 70% of 1RM and you're doing all of those to failure and you don't change the load, well, with longer rest, let's say 3 minutes versus 1 minute, you're going to be able to maintain more, more volume over that time, but you're not doing additional sets. And so it may not, in that case, the longer rest intervals may win out. you have a bit more more volume accumulated because you can recover more between each set. But if you're doing shorter rest, remember, you're finishing those four sets in a significantly shorter amount of time. So you could add more sets and potentially equate for volume. And that's what we do see in the literature. When you add more sets with shorter rest and you equate for that volume that you lost by fatiguing from set to set, hypertrophy tends to be similar. So I don't think it's anything magical about this, or I don't think shorter rest is necessarily harming muscle growth. It's just that on each set, you're going to perform a bit less. So you need to account for that volume by maybe adding some more sets. And if you do four sets of something and take 1 minute versus 3 minutes rest, if you add a set or even two sets, that's not going to increase time to finish the workout when you're in the shorter rest, right? Now, it doesn't mean that adding sets is always the right decision for you, for the individual, but it's just an important caveat that for hypertrophy, these findings, and when we say longer rest is better, it's when sets are equated. So I'm not necessarily, again, advocating for shorter rest here, but I do think that is a very important point to discuss. Now, longer rest intervals, I also think, are probably the way to go for strength, but I say probably because the third bullet point that I have here under caveats and explanations, if we can read that, says for strength, longer rest is probably better, but strength is more dependent upon peak load than average load. Thus, a peak top set on the first set could be sufficient. And I think that's important because this isn't something that's as cut and dry as maybe the textbooks would lead us to believe either. Not all studies that compare shorter versus longer rest show that longer rest leads to more strength. And I think that's because on that first set, they're doing the same load. And if that peak load is high on the first set, strength may be similar over time because that's going to be the most important set to maximize strength. And it doesn't take that much volume to maximize strength. So if you're losing a little bit of volume, that is okay. So as long as that first set is high. So overall for long-term outcomes, I can kind of scroll down below the table now. And the take home here being that sure, longer rest is probably ideal, but that's when sets are equated. If you can compensate for that volume with shorter rest, with some more sets, some more volume, I think you can be okay. Now, the other thing about shorter rest is, you know, there's a lot of ways to look at this, right? Because when a research study is completed, it's only comparing A versus B. And you could add maybe a bunch of sets by utilizing, I just did a thumbs up there, Trex. That's a firework and a thumbs up. If you can make some tallies, I want everybody to know on our team when we're done here that that's like two actions, whatever you want to call that. I have both of those, so we'll see how many it can get. But when you are, you know, taking shorter rest, you could potentially add in some other time efficient strategies that have really short rest, whether it's rest pause, drop sets, things like that. And yes, those are short rests, but remember, the literature tends to show that those lead to similar hypertrophy. And I think the reason being for that is because volume tends to be equated in the studies that do that. So yes, longer rest, you're going to maintain performance better. If you have the time to do it, probably the way to go. But short rest isn't going to crush your gains. You can absolutely get away with it. And there may be some practical advantages like keeping yourself engaged. And to get to Becky's question that she asked in the chat earlier, I think one of the issues that people have with longer rest sometimes is they end up taking too long, right? They get distracted. They sit around, they're looking on their phone, whatever it might be. And 3 minutes goes by, 5 minutes goes by, 10 minutes goes by, and it's, oh, I got to go do another set. And if that's you, then perhaps, and you're taking longer rest because you believe it's scientifically supported, which it is, perhaps you shorten it up a little bit, stay a bit more focused, you drop the weight from set to set, add a set, and you should be totally good to go in terms of muscle growth. Trex, a couple other things I want to get here. We have two more questions, but I want to pause there if you think there's anything from listening that you think I need to elaborate on, explain a bit more clearly, or go over for everyone here.
No, man, you're on a roll. I say we keep going with it.
All right, let's see if I can get some more fireworks. And so the third point here is what other factors might affect rest interval length, right? So we've covered acute performance, probably take longer rest, long-term outcomes, longer rest, but you add sets with shorter rest, you're good to go. But what other factors? Well, there's two things I want to highlight, which is that proximity to failure is going to affect rest interval length and certain exercises that cause more systemic peripheral fatigue may affect rest interval length. So this is one of the reasons why, although I'll try at the end, it's difficult to give uniform, exact, you know, rest 2 minutes between these sets, rest 3 minutes across the board for everyone, because these other factors are going to come into play. You don't know how everyone's training all the time. They're training with two repetitions in reserve. They're training to failure. Of course, you don't know individual rates of fatigue either. But because there's other factors that come into play, your rest time on a biceps curl is probably going to be different than your rest time on a squat. And so if you do a squat, you do a deadlift, something like that, by the time you rack the bar on a squat, you're going to need a little bit of time. If you're doing something like myo reps or rest pause on a squat, that's fine, but it's going to be difficult to do that continuously. If you are, though, you're probably using a lighter weight. If you're, you know, squatting and saying, hey, I'm really just going to train these sets of, 15 over and over again with a minute rest, that's going to be a bit difficult. So we need to take these other factors into account. So on our explanations here, training closer to failure can cause more acute fatigue and leading to greater performance decline from set to set. And that's a study that I reviewed coming out in the April 1st issue of Mass, where they looked at different rest interval times and different proximities to failure. And you got to subscribe for all of the details. But in short, this will be going out in our newsletter on April 1st, a very brief version, which is that if you're training closer to failure, you're going to fatigue a bit more quickly. You're not going to recover with 1 minute rest the same as you would training farther from failure. The interesting note there is that in the study, and again, I won't give away all the details, that it wasn't training to failure versus training not to failure. There were two non-failure groups. So even when training not to failure, it matters how close you train to failure for the fatigue rate, meaning 2 RIR with 1 minute rest intervals is going to fatigue a lot more quickly than 4 RIR with 1 minute rest intervals. So if you're training pretty far from failure, you could probably get away with pretty short rest. And I think that's important because if somebody were to train farther from failure, there's no reason to sit around for 4 or 5 minutes between sets. If you're saying, hey, I'm going to hammer home a ton of volume today, and I'm going to do this with 4 repetitions in reserve, you probably don't need to be sitting around thinking, oh, I need really long rest, especially on an assistance movement. You're going to recover pretty quickly, 1 minute rest, 2 minutes at the most, and you can go ahead and get back at it. So if I get to come with some examples that I've sketched out here, I want to look at what happens with short rest with closer to failure. And then how this would change, your performance would change. So in this first example, all we're really seeing here is that from set to set, performance is going to decline pretty rapidly if we're taking a short rest interval like 1 minute. So if we have 4 sets of 10 with 1 minute rest, you know, about a 10 RM around that area, we have 1 repetition reserve on the first set. Maybe we get 10 reps on the second set because we had 1 RIR on the first. And then we're really decreasing our performance, 7 reps and 5 reps. And I think I'm being charitable. I think with 1 minute rest close to a 10 RM, somebody would probably fatigue a bit more quickly than this. But on the next example down, if somebody's training shy of failure, or they have, let's say, 3 minutes rest and they're training shy of failure on the first set, their RIR might climb a bit closer to failure. With 3 minutes rest, you can see 10 reps on the first, 10 reps throughout, and that RIR scaling from 3 up to 0. And I think people forget about this way to train sometimes, you know, in this day and age when we're always talking about what's better, failure or not failure, and the meta regression that's been making the rounds for the past year or so. And we see, all right, maybe there's a slight edge for failure when we look at the overarching data, but To bring that into this discussion, because I do think it could impact rest intervals, what I would say is something we don't know is, if failure is better, how many of those sets need to be done to failure? Because in that meta regression, if one set was done to failure, there's another thumbs up, make the tally. If one set was done to failure, it was considered a failure study. So we don't know if somebody would need to do all 5 sets to failure. So I do think that when we look at rest intervals, if you take 2 to 3 minutes rest and you start out at about a 2 or 3 repetitions in reserve, that last set will probably be around a 0 RIR or 0 or to failure. probably a bit more sustainable than doing everything to failure, fatiguing really quickly, and needing really long rest intervals to maintain performance. So in a practical way, training a rep or two shy of failure to start could allow you to take a more moderate rest, like 3 minutes. You're not in the gym forever. Your RIR will climb more towards zero at the end. You'll get that stimulus you're looking for if you like training to failure, and you should be okay. But keep in mind overall here, when we talk about what we should do here in our take homes, my summary of this third question would be that we just really want to be cognizant of how close we're training to failure and how that affects your rest intervals. Because if you are training really close to failure, if you want to maintain performance, you're going to need to rest for considerably longer than if you're at 3 repetitions in reserve and you want to maintain performance. Additionally, even if, you know, let's go back and say, all right, longer rest intervals are better. If longer rest intervals are better, that's fine. But what does that mean on a curl versus a squat? Probably good to go 2 minutes on curls, 90 seconds on curls, even if you're thinking, quote, longer. But on squats or deadlifts or bench presses, if you're a powerlifter especially and you're really getting ready for a meet, you're probably looking at 5-6 minutes or so, depending upon the weight that's on the barbell. And with that said, the last big question that I want to tackle is how long should you rest, right? So this is a good segue into that because I have some rest interval recommendations up here on the screen. And this is where I said earlier that, and we should take all of these with a grain of salt, right? Because what I'm doing is I'm looking at the data, I'm looking at the rate of decline in performance that I showed in the Rademus table. I looked at all of the studies that I had in the table for question 2 in this document that looks at the long-term outcomes, saw what their rest intervals were, saw the rate of decline in performance, saw their long-term outcomes, and then kind of collated them for this table. And this table is from an upcoming issue of Mass. It's coming out on April 1st, but again, it's going out in our newsletter. So for those that are on our email list, they will see it at massresearchreview.com to get on that email list to get into our newsletter. And in this, I have a couple different circumstances because it's not as simple as saying, hey, rest for 3 minutes between all your sets, right? So if we look in the left-hand column, the first circumstance, let's say you have a lot of volume work on a main multi-joint movement, training at or close to failure. So a squat, a bench press for a lot of volume, closer to failure. This is where you're probably going to want the longer rest. Even if you could get away with 1 minute rest on those and then add some sets to compensate for the volume you lost by not resting longer, I would still probably want to let rest longer here. If you're squatting with 1 minute rest, close to failure, maybe you open yourself up to a technique error. That's not a world that I want to live in. Risk any injury. So I'd probably take 3 to 5 minutes rest. The reason being, well, we covered all of that here. Training closer to failure, you need a bit more recovery. And perhaps if you're training these lifts, they're a bit more geared towards strength for bench press and squat, things like that. So you might want to take a little bit longer on those. If we go down to the second row, we have kind of training on those multi-joint exercises again, but now we're training farther from failure. So a lot of volume, 3 RIR or more. You could rest, I think, considerably shorter here, 2 to 3 minutes, could probably even go 2 minutes. You're going to maintain performance better if you're doing 4 or 5 sets on that last set with the 2 minutes rest. Even if you're starting at 4 repetitions in reserve, you're probably going to be doing that last set to failure because you're still going to fatigue some, just not as much as you would if you took 1 minute rest or were closer to failure. Third row, training with heavy loads. This is where I would probably rest for longer. You're going to want to practice your technique the right way each time. If you're training with really heavy loads, that signals to me that you're someone that's interested in top-end strength. So I'd probably go for the 3 to 5 minutes plus. If you're a powerlifter out there, this is something that you probably do at times. You have 3 doubles at 1 repetition in reserve, maybe working up to an opener or second attempt, something of that nature. I'm going to rest a little longer, maintain strength, and maintain your technique from set to set. Assistance movements, 1 to 3 minutes, that's pretty broad because, again, it depends on the movement. If you're doing a bunch of barbell RDLs, you're going to maybe need to take a little bit longer than if you're doing some tricep pushdowns. But even if you went a little bit shorter on those 3 seconds or you use some time-efficient movements, I think that would be fine. But I hope this table is an actionable guide for everyone. keep it around. You know, just remember the factors that are going to affect your recovery between sets. It's not just your absolute rest interval, but also the exercise you're using and the proximity to failure in which you train. Lastly, and I'll keep this brief so we can get to some live questions tonight and have ample time to answer those, the additional notes at the bottom. I always find this an interesting question, which is, well, we're resting between sets unless we're doing something like drop sets. But is there something that we can really be doing with that time? Meaning, if we're saying take 2 or 3 minutes rest, what's the best use of it? Is it just sitting down? Probably not sitting down on a bench is the best use of that time. A bunch of things have been investigated in the literature. We've heard a lot about stretching between sets that could be agonist or antagonist. The short version of this is I'm not an optimist on interset agonist muscle stretching. I think there is some data you could interpret to slightly favor it, but I think the majority of data is pretty null on the topic, and it does impair performance from set to set. Antagonist muscle stretching, there's only 2 studies that I'm aware of, but it does actually seem to be quite positive. For example, if you're training the back to stretch the pecs in between sets. Interset foam rolling seems to be a pretty big negative. There's one study and another recent one that does show some positive, but there's about 5 other studies that show it to impair performance from set to set. Cooling the body, such as a cooling vest, crushed ice, things of that nature. Cooling the palms. There's a big time palm study from years ago, and I've talked about that in mass a little bit. We have yet to see those findings replicated, but there is some evidence for cooling the body between sets. But the most practical ones, and the ones I think we would probably use, are just low intensity movements, some low intensity cardio, walking around, trying to clear lactate is really the goal. So if we can clear lactate in between sets, if we are taking shorter rest intervals, the biggest takeaway from this is, don't sit down on the bench. If you're taking shorter rest, you're doing moderate, high volumes and moderate reps, move around a little bit, try and clear lactate the best you can. And then, do you need to actually time your rest intervals? Data does tend to show that people can rest pretty intuitively, meaning that, for example, when folks were given 5 sets of 5 at near a 5 RM and they weren't given a rest time, they just rested intuitively. They tended to rest for about 3-4 minutes, and they were able to complete all of the reps. I think only missing 1 rep in the entire study from EBOT. And so people can rest pretty intuitively. I'd want to know about where I am, but the overarching kind of message here is, I think the paradigm has shifted a bit too much in terms of longer rest. Not that the literature doesn't slightly favor longer rest for being better for hypertrophy, but that it's really when sets are equated and you can compensate for that volume with more sets if you take shorter rest. So I would do what keeps you most engaged in the session if your goal is muscle growth, because that's probably going to lead to more volume, and volume is ultimately going to be the king of what's determining progression for muscle growth. So I hope, as always, when I put together these guides for office hours, they are helpful for everyone.
Awesome. Now, we did have a follow-up question from Jardar down in the live chat. So for rest pause training, would it be necessary to add extra sets in order to get equal hypertrophy compared to straight sets with the recommended rest interval that's being suggested here?
Yeah. So in the literature that's out there, when rest pause and traditional sets or straight sets are compared, the volume does tend to be similar, which is likely why the results are similar. So yes, I would look for those volumes to be similar. Now, when you do rest pause, there's a few different ways to do it. You could say, all right, I was going to do 4 sets of traditional sets, so I'll do 4 sets of rest pause. But if you just do it that way, which is a totally fine way, but if you just do it that way and you pick your first set as, you know, your 15 RM, well, those next 3 sets, if you're only resting 20 seconds between sets, your volume, as you're alluding to, is probably going to be a bit lower because you're going to fatigue pretty quickly with only the 20 seconds rest. So another way to do that is, I would take, all right, I'm doing 4 sets of 10 traditional sets. That means I'm doing 40 reps. I would set yourself a 40 rep cap. Maybe pick a 20 RM to start, on your first set of rest pause, you do 20 reps, you take the 20 seconds rest, you do, you know, 12 reps on the next set, that's 32 reps. You keep doing that until you get to 40. So I'd probably equate for reps. I think that's a bit better way to do it, to be able to, you know, try and get the same growth, because in the research we're seeing equated volume. So I think equating for reps in that case is a bit cleaner than equating for sets. So I would use the reps model of rest pause in that situation.
All right. Sounds good. It looks like John also has another follow-up question, a similar question about antagonist supersets. It says 2 to 3 reps in reserve and accessory work for that stuff ideally. So like for, if you're doing supersets, it sounds like, should you do 2 to 3 reps in reserve, and should that be mostly for accessory work? Is that how you interpret that question there?
Yeah. And so just so everyone is on the same page, and this is a really good point, I'm glad John brought this up, thank you, is that, so in when we talk, I mentioned what you could do in between sets, and another way to go about this, something else you could do in between sets is more lifting, which is to use agonist-antagonist supersets. So if you're doing a row in the rest intervals of rows, do some dumbbell bench presses, right? Now you're training the antagonist muscle. The short story on this, which we've talked about in office hours before, is that this type of superset doesn't impair performance. And on the second exercise in that order, the performance, the reps might even improve or might even increase. Now, as far as training to a 2 or 3 RIR, as opposed to farther from failure or closer to failure, I don't think this is any different really than the recommendations that I would normally give on this, which is probably, you know, I would tend to train just slightly shy of failure for the most part. On assistance movements, going to failure a bit is totally fine. Maybe there's an advantage to that. Now, the one thing about that I think is overlooked when talking about agonist-antagonist supersets is just, if you were to do this all the time, I think it might, because it's more of consistent, constant, continuous exercise, might be a bit more fatiguing in that way, even if it's not, impairing acute performance. So keeping those sets a little shy of failure may be a good way to go up until maybe the last set, and then kind of take that one to failure, because then you're going to get a little bit of a break before the next exercise. But remember, if you do a row, if you're doing sets of rows and you typically take 2 minutes rest, but in an agonist-antagonist superset, you do a row and then you would do dumbbell bench press and then you take 2 minutes rest, you're actually getting longer rest before you go back to the row, which is why performance might increase, because you're getting the 2 minutes rest and you're getting the time it took you to do the dumbbell bench press, and you're training an antagonist muscle. So I'd say, sure, you can train those to 2 to 3 RIR. I think that's totally fine. I don't think you have to. But if you want to go to failure, maybe do that and then kick up the last set, the intensity up a little bit, and take that to failure.
Awesome. And I think we have one last follow-up question about rest intervals, which is good. I think that the fact that we're getting these follow-up questions suggests you've really hit on a topic that people are interested in here. So the question is, if you were doing long length partials, so partials with, you know, long muscle lengths, would that impact the way that you recommend rest intervals?
I think it might. So I didn't mention long length partials specifically, but it makes me think of the two things I said that could affect rest interval length were proximity to failure, and then the other important one was exercise selection. And so in exercise selection, I gave the example of Romanian deadlifts. And the reason I gave RDLs is because it trains the muscle through a long length. And so you're always typically sore the day or so after you do RDLs, even if you do them pretty consistently. And so if you do that from set to set, you're probably going to need a bit more rest on RDLs than you would on, let's say, bicep curls, for example, or tricep pushdowns, especially something like this. And so I think that's probably because the length you train the muscle through. And so if you're doing long length partials, that similar principle is going to apply, and perhaps to an even greater extent. So I don't know for sure, but because exercise selection does seem to affect rest interval length, and it's one of the reasons that we can't give just all out uniform recommendations like rest 3 minutes between every set or 2 minutes between every set, it's because of exercise selection. And I think this speaks to the exercise selection. So my inclination, based upon how I would view something like RDLs, would be to say, yes, you would probably want to rest a little bit longer. Not that it would be anything magical, to be clear, that would lead to more muscle growth, but just from a practical perspective, doing a lot of long length partials with 30 seconds or a minute rest, I think would be very, very difficult. So I would say, yes, you'd probably want to elongate the rest a little bit.
All right, good stuff. So Becky, via emoji, indicated that your thumbs up count was at 4. And I don't know if we explained that well enough for the folks who are going to be listening to this on podcast after the fact, but Skype did something. We record our video on Skype, and Mike apparently has particularly demonstrative hand gestures that he uses. So every time he moves his hands, there are these like graphics that appear on the screen. And sometimes it's as simple as a bunch of thumbs up appearing everywhere. Sometimes it's even more extreme visually, and we will see fireworks kind of take over his screen. I would hope that there is a way to disable that. You know, I think if you are like live streaming a funeral or, you know, doing a layoff or something, you probably don't want a bunch of fireworks going off on the screen as a celebration. But anyway, Mike, you are the person who triggers these responses via Skype, and I think Becky's count of 4 was at least 2 thumbs up ago. So you're setting a PR, I think, tonight.
Well, I have 2 things to say on that. One, I want to thank Becky for her service here to provide us with the exact thumbs up count. We appreciate it. And 2, you know, can I name drop? Is that allowed here on sure. Your show?
Okay.
A great man about a decade ago saw me give a couple talks by the name of Ryan Doris, and he told me that I was a great talker with my hands. He said to me that I used my hands really well, and he could just see that I was into it. I think he used a similar word to you, demonstrable, with my hand motions. And so he foresaw this, and I got to give him credit. He knew that I would get the fireworks on Skype one day.
Well, there you go. So Mike, speaking of fireworks, there's always a great deal of excitement in the chat when it comes to our hashtags. Of course, we've got Zordopamine, that is fan favorite. Had some other good ones trickling in. We also, for some reason, when you're on, we get a lot of people shouting out where they're joining us from, where they're viewing from. So we got hellos from Santa Cruz, California. We got one from San Francisco. I think we had a couple others there. So that's always welcome, folks. When you're in the live chat, let us know where you're watching from. Oh, Wisconsin in the United States. Let us know where you're watching from. Drop some creative hashtags in there. And we've got some emojis making an appearance tonight as well. It looks like a couple of goats. Perhaps, I don't want to rush to judgment, but maybe that's us, a couple of goats. You never know. All right, Mike, you have been doing a tremendous service. You've been talking for a very long time. I'm going to give you a breather here and address a couple questions that are in my wheelhouse. One question that we've got here, do protein recommendations need to be adjusted for energy expenditure? Should protein intake be measured as a percentage of total energy intake or relative to body mass? Well, those are 2 slightly different questions, in my opinion, and they could very well have been intended that way. I'm going to start with the second one because I think the second one's a little easier. I think protein intake, generally speaking, is better framed relative to something that is not energy intake. So whether you want to frame it relative to total body mass or relative to fat-free mass, I think both of those are preferable in comparison to a percentage of calories, because if you tell someone, hey, protein should be, I don't know, 20% of your calories or 25 or maybe even 30% of your calories, well, should someone really be slashing their protein when they decide to go on an aggressive cut? No. And in fact, quite the opposite. They probably ought to be increasing their protein intake when they go into a particularly aggressive caloric deficit. So for when you start to dig into some examples and applications, you start to see that there are some meaningful downsides of specifically framing protein relative to energy intake when it comes to protein targets, for example. So I prefer to frame protein intake relative to fat-free mass, but some people prefer doing it relative to total body mass. And in most cases, both of those will get you generally in the same ballpark. But I like fat free mass specifically because, you know, in past work, I've had to come up with recommendations that scale well across broad extremes of body composition. And so sometimes when you have someone and you're trying to give them a protein target, and let's say they are trying to lose 150 pounds, right? And so maybe they're 45% body fat. You might end up with a ridiculously high protein target if you're going scaled to body weight. That would not be remotely close to what they really ought to be aiming for. Now, the second part of the question, do protein recommendations need to be adjusted based on energy expenditure? I would say not necessarily. I think that energy balance could be something that you adjust protein intake based on, but I wouldn't say necessarily expenditure. So, for example, if someone happens to burn a lot of calories, let's say they're an athlete, right? If you look at doubly labeled water studies, it's not unusual to see certain athletes in certain sports who burn, you know, maybe 3,800, 4,000 calories a day on a regular basis. Well, if they're in neutral energy balance, if they're refueling at a level that's adequate to kind of cover all the expenditure that they're burning through practice and competition, they don't necessarily have increased protein needs beyond an athlete who's only burning 2,900 calories per day. The big question is, are they in neutral, positive, or negative energy balance? If someone is in particularly negative energy balance, meaning there's a large discrepancy between calories burned and calories consumed, and they are in a caloric deficit that's relatively sizable, those folks may have slightly elevated protein needs. And there's a lot of, you could argue about how much that matters, and it's probably more true for people that are very well-trained compared to people who are relatively untrained, but generally speaking, I would say you don't really need to adjust protein recommendations based on energy expenditure in isolation, but you may need to adjust it based on energy balance, meaning that most targets that you see for, you know, optimal protein intakes are kind of assuming that you're in neutral or positive energy balance, and you may need to adjust those if you slip into, you know, considerably negative energy balance because of introducing a fairly sizable caloric deficit. We got some people chiming in. We got people from Hong Kong, Sydney, Australia, Ohio. Another individual from Sydney, Australia. Mike, we might need to schedule a mass hangout down there in Australia. We've got Maryland, Oslo, Norway. See, I'm glad that I prompted folks to chime in here with where they are viewing from, because we are certainly international here. And it's interesting because we choose our time zone in a way that's most convenient for us, and the mass crew is predominantly in the Eastern time zone, and people who are joining in are pretty much anything but the Eastern time zone. I mean, we have Ohio and Maryland, but man, we are really all over the world. So maybe we shouldn't have thought so hard about when we should schedule these.
Well, if we did it just for us, for you and me, Trex, we would do this at about 5 a.m.
Well, that is true. Yes.
But, you know, I'm from Maryland, and we both went to college in Ohio.
Yes, we did. I spent almost I spent my entire life in Ohio from the age of 0 to 22. And it was good while it lasted, but I don't think I'm going back anytime soon, because if you do Ohio for 22 years, you pretty much hit the highlights. You will have seen most of what Ohio has to offer over that 22-year span. But it will always have a special place in my heart. And I've got a buddy who I'm working with at Duke here, who's also from the Cincinnati area. And every time they go visit a lot, and they come back with all the delicacies from Cincinnati, the Skyline Chili, Grater's Ice Cream. Cincinnati's actually got some really good stuff going for it. We've got someone checking in from the Middle East and someone checking in from Montreal, Canada, which is basically France.
How is Becky keeping an accurate count of the likes, yet it's 2 a.m.? I wouldn't have the energy for that.
You never know. Some people are just built different.
It's impressive.
We appreciate the effort. Now, there is another question I want to get into here, because I actually have my own set of graphical aids that are going to block your face here, Mike. So someone asked a little bit, the good Dr. Darren Coe, PhD, was asking if I could discuss how to calculate basal metabolic rate and how to use it in determining maintenance level of calories. And if I could maybe give some examples. So what I want to do, I actually just gave a flash talk on Saturday for the International Society of Sports Nutrition. And I had some slides that will actually work pretty well in showing what we're talking about here. So I am going to put those up here. Here we go. So they are on the screen now. So here's what we're looking at. When we're talking about estimating basal metabolic rate with equations, we are talking about kind of the largest single component of total daily energy expenditure. So if we're going to be using this to try to determine a maintenance caloric intake, you know, really we can estimate BMR all we want, but we ultimately need to get back to total daily energy expenditure because that is what's actually dictating our energy balance. So basal metabolic rate is going to make up usually 60 or 70% of total energy expenditure. We're also going to have the thermic effect of feeding, which is about another 10%. Exercise activity will make up another 5-ish percent. But of course, if you're an ultramarathoner, it's going to be more than 5%. That kind of depends on how much you exercise. And then non-exercise activity thermogenesis makes up the rest. So we really need to try to make sure we're estimating the entire collection of these components rather than just focusing on basal metabolic rate. But nonetheless, basal metabolic rate is where you would start. And the most common place to start here would be with one of these very common equations. So you may have heard of some of these, the Harris-Benedict equation, and there are multiple versions of it, the Mifflin-St-Gior equation, the Cunningham equation, the Ketch-McArdle equation. There's all sorts of these equations. If you look at the bottom two, Cunningham and Ketch-McArdle, you'll see that the only variable you actually have to put in there is fat-free mass. Now, if you look at the other ones up top, you'll see that they are actually separate. There's a male equation and a female equation, and within each one, you see things like height, weight, and age, right? And so if you think about it, okay, so looking at these top two equations, if you're trying to ask someone, okay, I want to know your biological sex, I want to know how old you are, I want to know how tall you are, and I want to know how much you weigh. What they're really trying to get at there is fat-free mass. They're just assuming that you don't have enough information to give a good estimate of how much fat-free mass you have. So whether you're using an equation that contains a variable fat-free mass or one that kind of beats around the bush and says, okay, I'm just going to look at your sex, age, height, and weight. Ultimately, what we're trying to get to is a sense of how much fat-free mass you have. And that's because fat-free mass is the single biggest determinant of basal metabolic rate or resting metabolic rate. Now, the problem is, before I get into the problem, we've got this resting metabolic rate or basal metabolic rate. We need to turn that into an estimate of total daily energy expenditure. And so usually the way we're going to do that is by using a fairly basic multiplier. This is the most common set of multipliers or correction factors. And you're basically going to choose a number between 1.2 and 1.9. You're going to use this multiplier to convert your basal or resting metabolic rate into your total daily energy expenditure. And the idea here is that more active people will have higher total daily energy expenditure. So what they're trying to capture here is this kind of vague multiplier that captures your exercise activity thermogenesis and your non-exercise activity thermogenesis. And so when you look at the description in these categories, they're trying to combine both your structured exercise and your unstructured kind of general day-to-day physical activity. Now, the one thing that's not being used here or not being mentioned here is the thermic effect of feeding. And in most studies, pretty much across the board, people say, let's just assume that's about 10% of your total daily energy expenditure and not think too much about it. And that's pretty much how the thermic effect of feeding tends to be handled. So you've got your basal metabolic rate through an equation. You are multiplying it by this physical activity correction factor. And that's totally fine, but what I'm showing here is a couple figures from a paper by Ponser and colleagues in 2021. And Ponser, actually, that's the lab that I work in at Duke, but this predated my time working in the lab. But a really cool paper. And what you can see on the left there is total energy expenditure on the y-axis and fat-free mass on the x-axis. And you can see that certainly there's a relationship. There's no question about that. But the amount of variation there, the variance in total daily energy expenditure, even for two people with the same amount of fat-free mass, is really wide. There's a very high magnitude of variation. And, you know, unfortunately, we can use this equation-based approach to do the best we can if we have no measurement devices and we're trying to kind of get a decent ballpark idea of what our total daily energy expenditure might be and therefore what our maintenance calorie level might be. But the reality is the relationship between fat-free mass and basal metabolic rate is there is a relationship, but it's far from perfect. And then when we try to use these activity correction factors, they're even farther from perfect. And so this equation-based approach is good for getting a ballpark estimate. But if you really want to know whether you're eating below or above your maintenance calories, or if you really want to try to titrate, it's probably worthwhile to get an idea of how many calories you're consuming on a regular basis and just watch your trends in body weight over time. And that should generally help you triangulate what your maintenance calories are. And therefore, you know, you can make adjustments from there if you're wishing to gain or lose weight or maintain weight, then you would just kind of stay put. All right, Mike, I want to use the remainder of our time to jump into the chat here and answer some questions. I know that we had some really good ones that are largely training focused, and that's why I gave you a little breather there to gather your energy, and I'm going to hit you with some rapid fire questions here, if that works with you.
Let's go.
Okay, we got a question about accessories for powerlifting. That sounds like a Mike question to me. Would you recommend utilizing as much of a stretch as possible to maximize hypertrophy or using joint range of motion closer to the competition movements? So would you focus on specificity with your range of motion, or would you try to get a really nice stretch there for your accessory work?
I think this is a really good question. So, you know, one thing I'll say about specificity is that over the years, I think I've evolved on this to be more of the mind that nothing outside of what you actually do is really that specific, right? And so I come at this from I'll bring it back to the question in a moment, but come at this from like a team sport perspective. People are always thinking, well, what's specific? What's going to translate to the field? Well, power is going to translate to the field in a lot of these sports or to the court. But thinking of what specific exercise can a soccer player do in the weight room to mimic a kicking motion, I think that's a bit kind of overblown. I think that individual needs to derive power and needs to train generally for power. So when I think of this from a powerlifting perspective, then, all right, for that assistance exercise, should it be something like some sort of bench press variation for bench press? Or should I be training more toward that maximum stretch? My answer is I don't see why it would have to make a binary choice, in that there are exercises that can be pretty specific. So if you're doing some sort of partial bench press or some sort of partial squat, right? There's a study from my good friend Caleb Basler a while back that looked at partial squats. And you know, what's funny is we don't mock people for doing board presses or partial bench presses, but we do when they squat high. And while people are just squatting really high and they should be squatting lower, but in Dr. Basler's study, he showed that when they were deliberately squatting high on purpose for the specific reason, it did seem to improve squat 1RM performance even slightly. And so I do think we can make the choice to be specific on that targeted exercise. But when we go more towards these quintessential assistance movements, and we're looking at working with dumbbells and then looking at curls and triceps extensions and so forth, the purpose there for me is muscle growth, right? Can I get more load under the barbell on bench press? Can I get more mass under the barbell on bench press when I'm pushing it up by doing these assistance movements? Can I generally get bigger shoulders to help with my bench press when I'm doing shoulder press? So on those exercises, I would say it's more of an exercise-specific thing. I would look more to maximize hypertrophy. And on that case, you're controlling that eccentric. You're still really maximizing the concentric, but you're having a more controlled eccentric. You have a little bit of stretch. Maybe you have some exercises that train through a longer range of motion, some long length partials. I think that is totally fine. But then when you're going to the assists movements that are variations of the squat, variations of the bench, variations of the deadlift, I still think you can utilize those. You know, if you're using a three count pause deadlift or whatever it might be, or a partial squat, I still think you can utilize those. And then on the other exercises, like those single joint exercises that we mentioned, or rows or something of that nature, that's when I think you can still go for the stretch and go to maximize hypertrophy. So I don't think it has to be a binary choice.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I've worked with clients who have more of a powerlifting focus, and I would say the majority of our accessory work has tended to be hypertrophy oriented. And so we would get a nice full range of motion and focus on executing those reps in the way that is, you know, most likely to maximize hypertrophy. But there are instances where the purpose of our accessory work is quite different, right? So like, for example, I might have someone who really is struggling with some of the cues to keep their chest up on the squat. Their squat mechanics are getting out of whack. We might be doing an accessory exercise that's more focused on, you know, correcting, you know, some technical shortfall that we're seeing in the competition lift. So for example, we might do like a front squat from pins, right? And try to really focus on keeping that chest up. And we might be, you know, so the range of motion would actually be shorter than a normal squat. You know, we'd set those pins a little bit higher, focus on the front squat, take a little load off the bar, just to kind of cue that idea of staying a little bit more upright and prevent that chest from collapsing in. So the thing that a lot of people forget, well, they don't forget, but it gets overlooked a little bit with powerlifting, is that it is a sport. You are performing in action at the highest level you can. And so it's, you know, bodybuilding, we tend to think of it as kind of a manifestation of physiology, right? Where there's nutritional inputs, training stimuli, and we think about the physiology a lot, but with powerlifting, there's some of that, you know. Sometimes someone will walk into the gym and you can say, hey, I bet they can bench 400 because, oh my God, look at them. But there's also some of these elements of execution, which is an area where accessory lifts, you know, you can, they may not be ultra specific in terms of exactly how the competition lift is done, but maybe you do leverage some elements of specificity to focus on a very specific application of that movement. All right, Mike, we've got another question here for you, and this one is right in your wheelhouse. Where'd it go? Okay, yeah. So we got a question from Alvin. Should I improve my aerobic conditioning in order to maximize the amount of volume that I can handle and thereby maximize hypertrophy?
Yeah, well, this is a great question. I don't have I don't think anybody has the exact answer to this. The first thing I'll say is, let me take part of this, which is so that I can maximize the amount of volume I can handle and thereby maximize hypertrophy. I don't think we should equate the maximum volume that you can handle to maximizing hypertrophy or being what you need for hypertrophy. So just because you can handle a certain amount of volume doesn't mean that you should do that certain amount of volume or that you need that amount of volume to maximize hypertrophy. However, to get at the spirit of the question, which is if I improve my aerobic conditioning, I should then theoretically be able to handle more volume. And then over time, as I do need to add volume, I'd be able to do that. My capacity for it would go up and so forth. My answer to that is that I don't know for sure. There isn't a lot of data to kind of that's been done on this to suggest this. My current PhD student, Zach Robinson, is investigating this right now as part of his dissertation, which is pre-registered and out there and for everybody to see. It is one of his exploratory metrics to look at if there is a relationship between aerobic exercise capacity and maximal oxygen consumption and the responses to higher versus lower volume. Whether we will see anything on that, I have not the slightest idea. I don't know. Theoretically, it makes some sense. But I wonder if, you know, the capillary density and the mitochondrial biogenesis that you get from the aerobic exercise is going to be beneficial, but only when we're at these really, really high repetition sets. I'm not sure if we're doing a bunch of sets with 8 reps and taking some rest, you know, 4 minutes rest, 3 minutes rest between them, it's really going to matter. It may, and it may be the kind of thing where, you know, we see a large difference between individuals that have, you know, a VO2 max of maybe 55 or something really high versus those that have a VO2 max of maybe 30. And when you're, you know, relative VO2 max of 30 and 55 and 30, that would be an absolute of you know, 5 and 3. But because at those ends of the spectrum, it's very possible that we're going to see that, and maybe just leaner people are able to do more on average. We do have a study from our lab in the past that showed when gone into a forced regression, looking at the factors associated with the number of reps performed at a given load, that body mass was the main predictor, meaning those that tended to be lighter on average tended to perform more reps. Those that tended to be heavier performed less reps. But that's also taking a leap, because that's saying that rep performance on one set is a predictor of how much volume you can handle, which isn't exactly the same thing. So my inclination is, just intuitively, probably what most people is that yes, in some way, if you're really out of shape and you're not a very lean individual, perhaps you're going to have a more difficult time recovering from set to set. But I don't think if we were to look at this as a continuous variable, we would see a linear relationship, meaning I don't think we would see somebody with a VO2 max of 50 would be handle more volume than somebody with a VO2 max of 47. But I think those in the 40s and 50s would probably be better than somebody in the 30s. So we're investigating this now and we'll see. But just as a side note, improving your aerobic capacity is usually going to be a good idea, just from a general health perspective and from the perspective of, you know, I see you have another question, Alvin, on concurrent training. I don't know if that's something we're going to answer in depth tonight. We've done that a considerable amount in the past. But the short answer on that is, I think you can improve your aerobic capacity by not interfering with resistance exercise in terms of just making smart choices, keeping the aerobic duration relatively short, 30, 40 minutes, keeping it spread out at least 4 hours from lower body exercise, if not 24, and keeping that dosage relatively moderate. And I think you should be fine. That would increase your aerobic capacity. And the question then also is, how much do you need to increase your aerobic capacity to maximize the volume you can handle? Certainly not that of a marathon runner. It could probably be a bit of a moderate increase and you'd be okay. So I don't think we'd see a linear relationship, but there's probably something there between really fit people aerobically and people that aren't fit at all aerobically.
Yeah, I think I feel very much the same way. I'm a bit of a skeptic on this notion that the vast majority of, this isn't necessarily a claim that was made, but I'm very doubtful that a huge number of avid lifters can really move the needle much by increasing their aerobic capacity in terms of their hypertrophy potential. But I do very much believe that it's possible to have low enough aerobic fitness levels that it can impede your ability to train effectively. So another way of saying that is there's probably some like minimum threshold in terms of aerobic fitness where you'd much prefer to be above it in order to really push yourself in the gym to kind of accumulate the type of training volume and intensity you need, you know, in order to really succeed in your strength and hypertrophy pursuits. But I'm very, very skeptical, like you are kind of indicating, that going from reasonably aerobically fit to exceptionally aerobically fit is really going to have much of an impact on your hypertrophy potential. And it's possible that I'm extending your words a little further than you would have, so I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that's at least my view of the matter. All right. So we got another question here. This one's about set volume. We actually have a pair about set volume, but looking at different timescales. So this first one is, so it sounds like Menno Henselmans was referencing James Krieger on a recent webinar and indicated that he didn't see the benefit of doing more than six sets for hypertrophy, adding that he didn't see how you could stimulate muscle growth much further when you go beyond six sets. I'm assuming that this is the number of sets per training session, right? Per muscle group. So for a chest workout, for example, maybe you do three sets of incline, three sets of flat. Okay. And the idea here is that that's about all you can do in one training session, and anything beyond that in the same session would kind of be junk volume. What do you think about that, Mike?
So I personally wouldn't make any very strong statements on this, in that I don't think we have enough evidence to make a clear determination. What I will say, though, and I have two comments here, is that I wonder if the set number shifts per session based upon the rest intervals, to throw it back to the beginning of this episode. If you're doing shorter rest, perhaps you're more fatigued, but maybe you can get a little bit more volume in that way and add some more sets. The other thing I'll say is, our lab is working on this meta-analysis right now, and I am not going to share them, but there are some preliminary results, and I want to give credit to Jacob Remmert and Josh Pelland for leading these. There's going to be two meta-analyses. This is Jake Remmert specifically, and he's done an absolutely phenomenal job. And from what I've seen of what the fellows have done, they've done some good work as always. The number that I'm seeing is a bit more than I would have thought, where it's, people seem to benefit within a session. But that being said, I don't think we can make really strong claims on this, and I'll reserve more judgment until that's done and released. And one of the reasons I don't want to say too much, although we'll put it out as a preprint, is, as you know, Truck's going through a meta-analysis. There's different ways to model the data and to see what is best fit. And I haven't looked at it as much as those guys have, but we are working on this. And I would say that the data that we have at the moment, I wouldn't be able to say, or I wouldn't feel comfortable saying going above six isn't going to do anything. And I do think there's other factors at play, specifically the rest intervals. Perhaps it does vary amongst muscle group a little bit, and so forth. And if you're doing something like a long length and partial, perhaps you would need fewer sets to be able to maximize muscle growth there because of the length you're training from. And with other exercises, you could benefit from more sets. So I wouldn't make any hard and fast claims on that, but I hope to have some more data for us soon.
Yeah, I mean, I've got an article coming out in a few days in the next issue of Mass about weekend warriors. So the people that shift all their work, all their exercise to the weekend, all their structured exercise. And I talk through kind of what that would look like and what the pros and cons might be, how viable that approach is. So I do encourage people to check that out in a few days when it's published. But I really struggle to embrace the idea that six is the best you can do in all scenarios. So kind of like you were saying, Mike, like I do think that the details matter here. If you told me that all of your chest training for the week comes on Saturday, that's your upper body day, you only train 2 days a week, upper body Saturday, lower body Sunday, I really struggle to believe that you doing six sets of chest on that one session per week is really going to be the best you can possibly do with that 1 day a week of training. Like I really struggle with that. I do suspect that if you have adequate rest between sets, if you are properly fueled for that workout, and maybe you even, if it's going to be like a marathon session because you can only free up time on Saturday, maybe you're drinking some carbs and amino acids during it, or just carbs. Carbs alone will probably be fine. I don't know. I think we can probably push beyond that six set kind of ceiling or proposed ceiling within that scenario. I think for someone who is doing really frequent training, maybe they start to notice that going more than six per session is kind of putting them in diminishing returns land because, yeah, you're already doing, you know, six sets per session, three or four sessions per week. At that point, you're going up from what, you know, 18 or 24 sets a week to, you know, what, you know, 24 to 30 or something. Like maybe that's why people have this impression, is because they're thinking about it in the context of relatively higher training frequencies. That would be what I speculate.
Yeah, and it might also depend upon the difficulty of each set. You know, what's the proximity to failure of those sets? You know, and how much can you get out of those? And I'll say that I think some of the findings we're looking at too will surprise folks on that as well, in that when you begin to do more sets, are they more beneficial if you're training farther from failure or closer to failure? And we'll see what that data says when the guys have finished it. But look out for Jake's paper on that. Josh's as well. His is going to be looking at weekly set volumes, but Jake's paper is on this specifically. So hopefully we'll have that out soon for people to read.
Good stuff. I look forward to seeing that. The other question on set volume. So what would be the estimated effect size of increasing sets per week from 6 to 8 per week up to the optimal range of 10 to 20 sets per week? Is it really worth it if someone is always in a time crunch? What do you think, Mike?
You know, I don't know in terms of, let's say, the exact effect size, but, you know, going from 6 to 8 to 10 to 20 per week, and now this is always interesting in how we define this, right? Because this, when we throw out there sometimes, Becky put it on the board, there's another thumbs up. When we go out, think about this sometimes, so they got 20 sets per week, that kind of sounds like a lot. But if you're thinking of it the way the meta-analysis from Schoenfeld that we all cite and we all talk about, I know another one, you're smiling. I'm just going to put my hands down and be like, I'm just like Ricky Bobby, right? I don't know what to do with my hands. 20 sets per week sounds like a lot. But in reality, if we count volume the way the Schoenfeld meta did, that's indirect sets. So if we're talking about doing, you know, 20 sets of biceps and you do, you know, 5 sets of rows, you know, one day, 5 sets of rows another day, and then 5 sets of biceps one day and 5 sets of biceps another day, that's 20 sets right there. So it's really not that much when we're considering doing those sets. So it depends how you count them. If you're talking about doing direct sets, I think in that way, you might get a little bit more benefit from that. And then I also would just think of the terminology of optimal range. I'm not sure 10 to 20 sets is the optimal range. Remember, in the meta that we all cite, it was 10 plus. And one of the reasons it was 10 plus is because at that time, there just wasn't that much data. Specifically, there wasn't that much data with really high volume studies. But since then, Schoenfeld has other original research study. We have the Brigato study. We have the Abe study. We have the NS study that's been making the rounds over the past, 4 or 5 months now or so. So I don't know if 10 to 20 is the optimal range, but if we just take those numbers and we say, hey, we're going to roughly double or go 2.5 times our sets from 6 to 8 to 10 to 20, I think that you'll get a benefit if in on average, I think most people will get a benefit, because I do think 6 to 8 is quite low. I think that's more of minimal effective dose. I'd even say 10 sets per week, especially if you're counting indirect sets, is pretty low. You know, you're going to get a decent, I would say more than a negligible effect from that type of progress. And not just because it's an increase, because I don't think a lot of people would get more than negligible effect going from 20 to 40. They'd have to be ready for that. But I just think 6 to 8 is low. So if you go from that to 10 to 20, or especially up closer to 20, maybe not right away, because you don't want to 2.5 times your volume in 1 week, but if you gradually work up there, I think it's going to be a pretty decent benefit. And I think the best way I can say it's going to be well worth your time to do that, until then you take a deload, just take a step back and then work back up a little bit. But it's going to be well worth your time, because that's a pretty big difference in what I would consider to be effective for a trained lifter. 6 to 8 is really, I'm just maintaining for a couple of weeks on this muscle group because maybe I'm doing some volume cycling on lower body and I'm doing 30 sets of quads and all I can muster up on my upper body is 8 sets per week. That's fine, but that's just not going to be enough in the long term for a trained individual. Of course, volumes are individual, but I think you'd get a solid benefit.
Yeah, this is also kind of a real world example of you know, a lot of times I openly lament that people who do statistical analyses are a little too eager to turn continuous variables into binned or categorized variables. So we can look at this as like the slightly less optimal range of 6 to 8 versus the optimal range of 10 to 20. But I think it's important to think like, what is, you know, are we really going to act as if going from 8 to 10, lower group to higher group, is the same as going from 6 to 20 sets per week? Because those are dramatically different changes, right? So I think it's probably more useful to kind of view this in a more continuous fashion and say, okay, if I'm not able to get all the way up to 20 sets per week because I'm really crunched for time, how much am I really leaving on the table? You know, and I would say, well, let's get what we can. You know, if we can get maybe 12 sets per week, great. You know, we're not too far off from 20 necessarily. And, you know, I think it's a matter of degrees. You know, the further off you are from kind of these higher set volumes per week, you know, theoretically, you know, you might be leaving more on the table. But, you know, we have to understand that this relationship probably is nonlinear, this idea of diminished returns, right? So if you can bump from 6 to 8, great. If you can bump from 6 to 12, terrific. You know, bumping from 16 to 20, probably not as big a deal as bumping from, you know, 8 to 12, right? So I think it's important to view this as a matter of degrees. And ultimately, the biggest thing when I'm talking to someone who's really crunched for time with training is it's really critical to understand that we always talk about diminishing returns up on the high end, but the implicit relationship there that is discussed less frequently is the fact that there are huge opportunities in just doing some, right? Like the difference between doing nothing and some is enormous. The difference between doing kind of a lot and definitely a lot isn't very big. So it's important to not get discouraged from having short time available for training. Make sure that you're taking advantage of the time you have, even if you're only doing 4, 6, 8 sets per week for a muscle group. Quick one for you, Mike. There was one here about the interference effect. Is cardio, you know, the interference effect from cardio a systemic effect, i.e., can I do upper body lifting and lower body cardio in the same session and not have to worry about the interference effect?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So it is not a systemic effect in a direct way. So there's a good study from Sporer and Wenger that came out, I think, in 2003. And in Sporer and Wenger study, I'm going to try to remember off the top of my head here, what they did for the most part, which is that I believe they had individuals do, let's say, a lower body training session. And then at, I think, 4 hours, like 4 hours, 8 hours, maybe 12 hours and 24 hours later. No, immediately 4 hours, 8 hours and 24 hours later. They tested following the lower body training session, lower body strength, lower body rep performance, and that was decreased and didn't recover until 24 hours. But also following lower body training session, they tested upper body strength, bench press reps performed, and they found that those weren't affected. So essentially, if you train the lower body or train the upper body aerobically, you're going to be able to still perform you know, the opposite muscle group, the upper or lower, okay. So if you go ahead and say, all right, I'm going to go and ride the bike or jog on the treadmill, then go do some bench press, your rep performance didn't seem to be decreased. Now, of course, we have to give the caveat there. That's, think of the intensity that you're doing. If you're going to say, hey, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to run, you know, 15 miles today with some hard miles in there, and then I'm going to go bench press right after, that's not going to go so well. But if you're going to go ride the bike for 30 minutes at a moderate intensity, whatever it might be, and then you're going to go bench press, you should be fine. So acutely, it's not going to affect that. But the reason I said it doesn't directly is because indirectly, for the other example I gave, if you just do it so much and so intensely and for so much duration, you're going to have some fatigue, even if it's not, you didn't specifically train that muscle group and you don't have acute damage of that muscle. You're still going to be fatigued from doing an hour of hard running right? You can't do an hour of tempo or threshold running, at 80% of your heart rate, and then go ahead, hey, I'm going to go and bench press now a bunch of reps and be effective on that. It's not going to happen. But you can do a more typical, let's say, quote, lifter's cardio of, you know, cycling for 30 minutes or so, and then go to the bench press, and I think you'll be fine. So if that's the only way, and we always say, and I always say when I talk about it, you're going to want to separate cardio, let's say, by 4 hours from a lower body workout, assuming you're cycling or running or something like that. But if you, the only way to get your, both your aerobic and your resistance exercise in is to kind of put them close, both in close proximity, then the way to do it would be to do what this individual is getting at here, is what they're suggesting, which is to say, all right, I have to do my cardio and my upper body training in the same session. No problem, right? How can I space these out? What I would do in that case is I would probably do my lifting first if lifting is your main goal. And the folks in this chat, I'm assuming that for the most part, that strength and hypertrophy is your main goal. So I would do the bench pressing first and then perhaps do the cycling or running aerobic exercise after, and you should be good to go. But if you did flip-flop it and you did more of a lifter's cardio, I don't think your upper body performance would be too affected.
All right, good stuff. Mike, I think that's probably going to do it for us tonight. We're right at about 8:30 here, which is a bummer. We had some great questions. Bill had a good question in here about kind of like motor skill acquisition, which I think maybe next time you're on, we can touch on that.
Can I get to that one real quick?
Sure. Yeah, go for it.
So unbeknownst to you and unbeknownst to me, I mentioned before, I don't know if the listeners remember this, they should, because it's one of the most important pieces of information that I've dropped on the podcast, is that I currently hold the position. If you notice, the end of this message says, go Phil, so he revealed himself. I currently hold the position as Cooper City, Florida, under 8 boys assistant baseball coach. This is not a position anybody can get. I had to fill out the turquoise form. Again, not the light blue form, but the turquoise form. If you do that, you do get to be an assistant coach. This gentleman here is the head coach of the team, and he is talking about improving pitching mechanics. And I can't talk about that in a second. But for the folks out there, I did get a chance to pitch in one of our team's games this year. I lasted 2 innings before I got yanked. Our other assistant coach, Coach Rich, came in. He was an ace, man. He crushed it. And so we stuck with him. We're going to go with him in an upcoming game when the head coach can't be there. But we're having a lot of fun this year. And, you know, it's funny, a process in terms of pitching mechanics. I have gotten better since then. But let me tell you, it's not that easy to throw to the kids, because it's not like throwing to an adult. You can't, like, throw it in there on a line. You kind of got to put a little bit of loft on it, and then you kind of mess with your motion a little bit.
Yeah.
But to not go on that too much and to talk about, let's say, mechanics, you know, this is another thing. If you are, this made me think of this, you know, Trex, if you are in the Mass Research Review, we do have some articles out there on practice and, you know, kind of how you should go about this and things like contextual interference and so forth. So that's a time for another day. But don't worry, next time I'm on, we should have played about 4 or 5 more games. And I'll update everybody on how the Phils are doing and our push for the all-important under-8 playoffs. It does not get more intense than that.
Good stuff. Yeah, next time you're on, we should talk a little bit about practice and skill acquisition and a little bit of motor learning, because those are areas that we do every now and then touch on those in the Mass Research Review, and yeah, and a lot of folks are interested in that stuff.
Yeah, not the game, though. We're not talking about the game. We're talking about practice.
Yeah. Practice, absolutely. Yeah, so I want to thank everyone who joined us on this lovely Wednesday evening. If you haven't yet, I will trouble you, I beg you, to hit the like button. It helps us out immensely. And while you're at it, go up, copy that URL for today's episode, send it to your 10 best friends. They'll appreciate you for it. It's good, free entertainment, and they may learn something while they're at it. So be sure to like and subscribe and share and all that stuff to support the show if you like it. We very much appreciate you for joining us. I will be back in exactly 1 week, probably with Dr. Helms. I don't know. I'm going to have to check the schedule to confirm that, but I'll be here with somebody on the Mass Research Review team, which means it is sure to be another fantastic episode. So everyone, have a great night, have a fantastic week, and I will see you soon.